Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now! President Trump has directed the Pentagon to resume testing nuclear weapons for the first time since 1992. He made the announcement just before meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping to discuss trade relations. We'll get the latest on both stories. Then to Sudan, where the RSF militia is being accused of killing over 2,000 people, including over 400 in a hospital, after capturing the city of El Fasher in Darfur. Then to Cuba. On the same day Hurricane Melissa battered the island, the United Nations voted to condemn the U.S. embargo for a 33rd year in a row. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Sudan's government says the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group has killed at least 2,000 people in the 3 days since it seized control of the city of El Fasher in North Darfur. This comes as the World Health Organization says it's appalled by reports that 460 patients and their companions were slaughtered at the Saudi maternity hospital in El Fasher. On Wednesday, UN Refugee Agency official Jacqueline Wilma Parlevliet said tens of thousands of displaced people have been arriving at Tooele, a refuge for civilians fleeing the violence. They describe widespread ethnically and politically motivated killings and indiscriminate attacks, particularly affecting the most vulnerable.
We have accounts of people with disabilities who were executed, who were killed as they were unable to flee. But we also hear people that are trying to leave the city and manage to get out of the city, but on the way they're caught up and they are also being shot.
In Gaza, Israel's military launched several airstrikes on the southern city of Khan Yunis this morning, even after it announced a resumption of the ceasefire. The bombings followed a wave of Israeli attacks a day earlier that killed at least 104 civilians, including 46 children. On Wednesday, friends and neighbors held a funeral procession through Nuseirat for the Abu Dalal family, killed by an Israeli strike on their home.
Nine people from the Abu Dalal family and the house next to us were completely wiped out. Not a single person survived. They pulled them out, all as remains from under the rubble, remains. They would bring a piece of the body and say, this belongs to so-and-so. Bring a hand and say, this belongs to so-and-so. It was a very difficult process.
Meanwhile, Israeli forces have intensified raids across the occupied West Bank, storming villages near Jenin and Ramallah. Separately, Israeli settlers stormed a Bedouin village east of Jerusalem, destroying Palestinian property and blocking roads. In another incident, Israeli settlers cut down hundreds of olive trees near Nablus. The settler attacks came as Israeli authorities said they would deport two Jewish women who recently joined Palestinians harvesting olives. In a statement, the group Rabbis for Human Rights said, quote, the decision to deport these volunteers reflects an alarming trend of silencing nonviolent human rights work and Jewish voices for justice in Israel-Palestine, unquote. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said Wednesday the Pentagon had bombed another alleged drug trafficking boat in international waters in the Eastern Pacific, killing four people. In a social media post, Hegseth wrote, quote, "The Western Hemisphere is no longer a safe haven for narco-terrorists bringing drugs to our shores to poison Americans," unquote. He provided no evidence supporting his claims there were drugs aboard the vessel. This comes as CNN is reporting the Trump administration pushed three-star general Joe McGee out of his role on the Pentagon's joint staff following months of tensions with Secretary Hegseth on issues ranging from Russia and Ukraine to the extrajudicial killings in the Caribbean. President Trump says he's agreed to a one-year trade truce with China that includes the rollback of some tariffs following face-to-face talks in South Korea with Chinese President Xi Jinping. As part of the deal, Beijing agreed to postpone export controls on rare earth minerals and said it would crack down on fentanyl trafficking. China also agreed to resume buying American-made soybeans. We'll have more on the Trump-Xi summit later in the broadcast. President Trump says he's instructed the Pentagon to begin testing nuclear weapons for the first time in 33 years. Citing China and Russia, Trump wrote on his Truth Social platform, quote, "Because of other countries' testing programs, I've instructed the Department of War to start testing our nuclear weapons on an equal basis," unquote. It is unclear what he was referring to. Russia and China have not tested a nuclear weapon in decades. North Korea tested a nuclear weapon more than 8 years ago. The U.S. conducted its last nuclear test back in 1992, soon after President George H.W. Bush announced a moratorium on nuclear weapons testing. After headlines, we'll have more on the story. Hurricane Melissa is bearing down on Bermuda after leaving a trail of destruction across the Caribbean with at least 34 confirmed dead, most of them in Haiti. Jamaica's confirmed at least 8 deaths after Melissa made landfall Tuesday as one of the most powerful Atlantic hurricanes on record. This is Sasha Hamilton, a resident of the hard-hit Catherine Hall neighborhood of Montego Bay in Jamaica.
Yesterday was absolutely catastrophic and life-threatening. We were totally inundated. The entire ground floors of all the houses in Catherine Hall and West Green have been flooded. Major asset loss to vehicles, furniture. We had to do rescue. And we are literally desperate for some help at this point.
According to AccuWeather, Hurricane Melissa could cost Jamaica $22 billion in damages and economic losses, more than Jamaica's annual gross domestic product. Rebuilding could take more than a decade. The United Nations General Assembly has condemned the U.S. embargo on Cuba for the 33rd consecutive year. On Wednesday, 165 countries voted in favor of a non-binding resolution calling on the U.S. to lift the embargo, while 7 nations, including the U.S., Ukraine, and Israel, voted against it. This is Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez.
The blockade is collective punishment as an act of genocide which flagrantly, massively, and systematically violates the human rights of Cubans. It doesn't distinguish between social sectors or economic actors. If the United States government had the smallest concern with helping the Cuban people, as they say, suspend or make humanitarian exceptions to the blockade, given the damage it will cause, just like Hurricane Melissa is causing.
Wednesday's vote came as the hurricane struck eastern Cuba, causing major damage but no deaths after more than 700,000 people were evacuated. Later in the broadcast, we'll get an update from reporter Liv Oliva Fernandez, who's on the ground in Santiago de Cuba. The U.S. federal government shutdown has entered its 30th day. On Wednesday, Senate Majority Leader John Thune blocked a bid by Senate Democrats to fund food assistance through the shutdown after the Trump administration refused to draw from a $5 billion contingency fund to maintain SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Without federal funding, some 42 million people who rely on SNAP could lose benefits beginning on Saturday. A congressional candidate in Illinois' 9th District has been indicted in federal charges by the Department of Justice. Democrat Kat Abugazela faces one count of conspiracy and one charge alleging she, quote, forcibly impeded, intimidated, and interfered, unquote, with an ICE officer. She's been frequently protesting outside the ICE facility in Broadview, Illinois. Soon after her indictment, she posted this video on social media.
As I and others have exercised our First Amendment rights, ICE has hit, dragged, thrown, shot with pepper balls, and tear gassed hundreds of protesters. Simply because we had the gall to say that masked men coming into our communities, abducting our neighbors, and terrorizing us cannot be our new normal. And because Chicago doesn't back down from bullies in masks who tear gas our neighborhoods, this administration has resorted to weaponizing the federal justice system to scare us into silence. But we're not going to be silent.
To see our interview with Kata Bugazela, go to democracynow.org. The Department of Justice has suspended two federal prosecutors after they referred in court documents to the January 6th insurrection as being carried out by a mob of rioters. The prosecutors, Carlos Valdivia and Samuel White, had filed a sentencing memo against January 6th rioter Taylor Taranto, who was pardoned by President Trump on the first day of his second term in office. The two prosecutors were seeking 27 months in prison for Taranto for bringing guns and illegal ammunition to President Barack Obama's home in 2023 after Trump posted Obama's Washington address on social media. By Wednesday afternoon, the sentencing document was removed and replaced with another document without references to January 6th, Trump's social media post, and the two prosecutors. A jury in Illinois convicted Sean Grayson, a sheriff's deputy, of second-degree murder in the 2024 shooting death of Sonia Massey, a black mother of two, who had called 911 herself about a suspected prowler. Grayson was originally charged with first-degree murder, but the jury opted to convict him on a lesser charge. That prompted anger from Massey's supporters, including her father, James Wilburn.
There's a difference in this country when you have my skin color and Grayson's skin color. We need serious justice, not a miscarriage of justice that happened here in Peoria. We need to pass the George Floyd Policing Act. We need to pass the John Lewis Voting Act. We need to make the Sonia Massey law across the whole United States. Then no family in our country can go through what our family has gone through.
In July 2024, Sean Grayson and another deputy arrived at Massey's house after she reported suspicious activity. Grayson then shot Massey after he confronted her about handling a pot of hot water. There is no indication from body cam video that Massey intended to throw the hot water at either officer. And in the Netherlands, the center-left D66 party made huge gains in national elections, winning the largest share of seats in the Dutch House of Representatives. The far-right anti-immigrant party of Geert Wilders lost support and came in second. The election was triggered after Wilders pulled his party out of the government in June after the other parties refused to endorse his anti-refugee policies. The election results allow the 38-year-old Rob Jetten to form a government as the Netherlands' youngest and first openly gay prime minister.
This is an historic election result because we've shown not only to the Netherlands but also to the world that it is possible to beat populist and extreme right movements.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. We begin today's show looking at U.S.-China relations and President Trump's threat to resume nuclear weapons testing. President Trump and President Xi Jinping met in South Korea and agreed to a one-year trade truce. But the trade deal was overshadowed by Trump's announcement that the U.S. would resume testing nuclear weapons for the first time since 1992. Just before his meeting with Xi, Trump wrote on Truth Social, quote, "Because of other countries' testing programs, I have instructed the Department of War to start testing our nuclear weapons on an equal basis. That process will begin immediately," Trump wrote.
It's unclear what President Trump was referring to. Russia and China have not tested a nuclear weapon in decades. North Korea last tested one in 2017. Trump spoke briefly with reporters after his meeting with Xi, flying back to the United States.
have to do with others. They seem to all be nuclear testing.
Russia?
We have more nuclear weapons than anybody. We don't do testing. We've halted it years, many years ago. But with others doing testing, I think it's appropriate that we do also.
Any
details
really,
around the testing, sir? Like where, when?
It'll be announced. You know, we have test sites. It'll be announced.
Trump's threat to resume nuclear tests comes just months before the last major nuclear arms control treaty between the United States and Russia expires. The new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or New START, expires February of next year. We go right now to Dr. Ira Helfand. He's an expert on the medical consequences of nuclear war, former president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, which won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985. He also serves on the steering committee of the Back from the Brink campaign. He's today joining us from Winnipeg, Canada, where he's speaking at the 5th Youth Nuclear Peace Summit. Dr. Helfand, welcome back to Democracy Now! You must have been shocked last night when just before the certainly globally touted meeting between Trump and Xi, Trump sent out on social media that he's going to begin testing nuclear weapons, comparing it, saying that we have to test them on an equal basis, referring to countries like Russia and China. Can you explain what he is talking about? They, like the United States, haven't tested nuclear weapons in decades.
Good morning, Amy. Actually, I can't explain what he's talking about because it doesn't make any sense. As you pointed out, Russia and China have not tested nuclear weapons for decades. And I think the most important thing right now is that the White House has got to clarify what President Trump is talking about. If we really are going to resume explosive nuclear testing, this is an extraordinarily destabilizing decision, and one which will increase even more the already great danger that we have of stumbling into a nuclear conflict. But they need to clarify this because, as you pointed out, the statement doesn't make sense in terms of what's actually happening in the world.
And Dr. Helfand, what would these tests entail were this to actually occur the way that Trump has said?
Well, again, it's not clear what he's talking about. If he is speaking about resuming explosive nuclear testing, presumably this would not be in the atmosphere, which is prohibited by a treaty which the United States did sign and ratify in 1963, but it would be underground nuclear explosions. And the principal dangers there, I think, is political. This will undoubtedly trigger a response by other countries that have nuclear weapons and dramatically accelerate the already very dangerous arms race that the world finds itself in today. The one perhaps value of this statement is that it helps to draw attention to the fact that the nuclear problem has not gone away, as so many of us would like to believe. We are facing the gravest danger of nuclear war that has existed on the planet since the end of the Cold War, and possibly worse than it was during the Cold War. And this comes at a time when the best science we have shows that even a very limited nuclear war, one that might take place between India and Pakistan, has the potential to trigger a global famine that could kill a quarter of the human race in 2 years. We have to recognize that reality, and we need to change our nuclear policy so that it is no longer based on the idea that nuclear weapons make us safe, but that it recognizes the fact that nuclear weapons are the greatest threat to our safety. And for citizens in the United States in particular, I think this means doing things like are advocated by the Back from the Brink campaign, calling on the United States to stop this tit-for-tat exchange of threats with our nuclear adversaries and to enter into negotiations with all 8 of the nuclear armed states for a verifiable, enforceable agreement that will allow them to eliminate their nuclear arsenals according to an agreed-upon timetable. And so they could all join the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons at some point when they have completed this task. This idea is dismissed sometimes as being unrealistic. I think what's unrealistic is the belief that we can continue to maintain these enormous nuclear arsenals and expect that nothing is going to go wrong. We've been lucky over and over again. This year alone, 5 of the 9 countries which have nuclear weapons have been engaged in active military conflict. India and Pakistan were fighting each other. That could easily have escalated into a nuclear war between them, which could have had devastating consequences for the entire planet. And we keep dodging bullets, and we keep acting as though that's going to keep happening. It isn't. our luck is going to run out at some point, and we have to recognize that. And we have to recognize the only way to guarantee our safety is to get rid of these weapons once and for all.
Dr. Helfand, before we conclude, just about the timing of Trump's comment, which came just days after Russia said it had successfully tested a nuclear-armed missile, which it said could penetrate U.S. defenses. Do you think Trump was responding to that without perhaps understanding that there was a difference between that and carrying out explosive nuclear tests?
It's certainly possible, and the timing suggests that maybe what's happening. But again, the White House needs to clarify this statement, because as it stands, it was an explicit instruction to begin testing at the test sites, which suggests nuclear explosive testing. I suspect that is not what the president meant, but at this point, who knows?
Right. It was nuclear capable, not nuclear armed. And finally, I mean, he's talking about doing this immediately, instructing what he called the War Department, the Department of War. Isn't the Energy Department in charge of the nuclear stockpile? And aren't scores of nuclear scientists now furloughed during the government shutdown? Who is maintaining this very dangerous stockpile?
But that was another striking inconsistency in that statement. It is not the Pentagon, which he referred to as the Department of War, that would be conducting nuclear testing if it recurs. It is, Amy, as you suggested, it's the Department of Energy that is responsible for this activity. So again, another area in which the statement is just confusing, puzzling, and needs clarification. And I think, you know, this is a really urgent matter, because as it stands, the statement itself is destabilizing. It raises tension. It creates further problems. And we don't need that anymore.
And opens the door for other countries, is that right, to test nuclear weapons?
Well, absolutely. And that would be, you know, there'd be absolutely nothing the U.S. could do that would more undermine our security at this point with regards to nuclear weapons than to resume testing. It would give a green light to many other countries to resume testing as well, and lead to a markedly increased instability in the global situation.
Dr. Ira Helfand, we thank you so much for being with us, former president and physician for social responsibility, won the Nobel Peace Prize, PSR, in 1985, serving on the steering committee of the Back from the Brink campaign. Joining us, interestingly, from Winnipeg, Canada, where he is speaking at the 5th Youth Nuclear Peace Summit. Coming up, we look at the U.S.-China trade truce and President Trump's meeting with Xi Jinping for the first time in years, even if the meeting did not last even 2 hours. Stay with us. Our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to look at U.S.-China trade relations after President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping agreed to a one-year trade truce during their meeting in South Korea. Trump agreed to cut fentanyl-related tariffs to 10%, while Beijing agreed to postpone export controls on rare earth minerals and crack down on fentanyl trafficking. China also agreed to resume buying American-made soybeans. On Thursday, she talked about the importance of China-U.S. relations.
I always believe that China's development goes hand in hand with your vision to make America great again. Our two countries are fully able to help each other succeed and prosper together. Over the years, I have stated in public many times that China and the United States should be partners and friends. This is what history has taught us and what reality demands.
She was speaking through a translator. We're joined now by Nancy Chen, professor of economics at Northwestern University, co-director of Northwestern University's Global Poverty Research Lab and founding director of the China Econ Lab. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Professor Chen. What was most significant to you about this deal that was made between President Trump and Xi?
I think the thing that really stands out to me and probably many others is simply that they met. You know, geopolitical competition has been increasing steadily since Trump won. It escalated during Biden and even more so during Trump too. So there was a real concern about how this competition is going to play out. You know, are we going to end, you know, worst case scenario, are we going to end up in conflict or can we get a dialogue going? So I think the fact that they met at all has to be a good thing, right? Talking means not fighting. Talking means hopefully more talking. And I think that's the biggest takeaway for all of us.
Professor Chen, what do you think prompted this meeting now?
You know, China and the U.S. has been kind of playing shadow boxing and all-out boxing for years. You know, all the levers and buttons that they can push and pull in order to compete have sort of been played out. They've been pushed and they've been pulled, right? So at this point, it's sort of like, what now? Tariffs. Are we going to go from 100% to 200% to 300%? You know, we've gotten to a point where it doesn't really have meaning anymore. So they sort of have to talk.
So if you can talk about the different points of this agreement, for example, the soybeans, isn't this all a creation of Trump? I mean, he caused the problem and then solved it, right? He increased the tariffs. China said they were going to cut off buying soybeans from the U.S. They're a major buyer of those soybeans, which really endangered American soybean farmers, and was buying it from Argentina that Trump is bailing out to the tune of $20 billion at least. Explain what were these issues from fentanyl to soybeans and beyond?
So 20% or so of U.S. soybean exports go to China. China's a really big buyer. So when Trump raised tariffs on the Chinese goods, you know, the Chinese retaliated in many ways. One way was to say, we're not going to buy agriculture exports from the U.S. And this was really smart on the part of the Chinese. Not only do the Chinese have a lot of economic power and being such major buyers of American agricultural products, you know, these are also farmers. American farmers are also in red districts. These are the places that voted for Trump. So they were tactically trying to reduce political support for Trump economic policies from Trump's red political base. And it's not just soybeans, as you've alluded to, it's many other things. So one thing that we don't think about much in the United States is whey. So for those of us who don't know what whey is, it's a protein that comes from milk. In the U.S., we don't really consume much of it. It's usually, we see it in the form of protein shakes, right, for people who want to go to the gym or bodybuilders. But in China, it's a nutritional supplement that's used by school children, the elderly, and it turns out that 40% of whey exports go to China from the U.S. So this is just another product that China has a lot of economic power over. And what's happening since, you know, Trump has increased tariffs, actually, it goes further back than that. Since Trump won, the U.S. and China have been preparing themselves for more escalation, more economic competition. And the way that China has been doing it is to build up food reserves so that they don't need to rely on U.S. exports, and to build up economic relationships with countries like Argentina and Brazil so that they can import foods from these other countries in case they get into a tat with the United States. So I think what we're seeing in terms of soybeans is just one of the strategies that's being tested out, right? So China is saying, how much power can we get by pulling our economic levers in terms of how much we import from American farmers? And the U.S. is trying to figure out how much political support will we lose if American farmers are hurt. And what we're seeing now is these things being played out, and that's why we see the shifts back and forth, because it's part of a larger political and economic experiment.
And Professor Chen, I mean, there's also the question, the fact that China trades more with more countries in the world, 70% more countries China has trade with than the U.S. If you could talk about 70%, 150 countries, if you could talk about the significance of that.
So that's a really great point. You know, one of the things that we need to remember when we talk about trade between China and the U.S. is that these are very large and diverse economies, and trade in total is only a part of the economy, not to mention trade with each other. So while they can really hurt each other by reducing trade with each other, they also have many options to other countries. So for China, 20% of its GDP relies on exports. And as you say, China trades with many countries other than the United States. That